You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
He's still going. I have a question. Is it possible we could get the Telemundo broadcast guy in the booth with Mitch Holthus just for one touchdown?
Oh, that would be awesome.
I would love to hear that when Mahomes fires one all the way down the field to Travis Kelce. And then on a loop, we could just bring it back when we wanted to.
Like, Argentino!
It's so good.
Oh!
You guys, it went on for 21 seconds, that goal.
It's still going on.
It is still. I think if we found him today, he would still be screaming. We are thrilled because we know how short she is on time to welcome a good friend of the program, Kathy Nelson, in. To give us a little breakdown about the great month that was, and here she is, the president and CEO of Visit KC and the Kansas City Sports Commission. I was hoping you would be on vacation today. You are not.
Who has time for that right now? There's too much to celebrate and too much to do.
I have so many questions for you. I've looked at some of the numbers. We had, 275,000 match attendees, more than 300,000 visitors at the National World War I Museum with the FIFA Fan Fest. What else can you tell us now that the actual, you know, Kansas City part of what was going on here is over with respect to the matches?
Well, we still have a lot of information to gather. It will be weeks, if not months, before all of our numbers come in. But I think we all felt it. We felt the energy. We felt the flights. We felt the people. We felt the lines. I can tell you from at least my seat and what our two organizations do, it was an exhausting and exceptionally emotional and positive 2 months.
I think people are sadder, Kathy, than they thought they would be. That this is over. Like when it was over, when the last match was done, I think there's like this kind of like a letdown, like, oh, they're leaving now. When can we do this again?
I know. And the music you were playing while I was on hold, I was a little teared up hearing that song. I'm like, oh, it is sad. I have no words right now. It's just so emotional. I had quite a few tears yesterday. I had tears Saturday night. And yesterday, I don't know about all of you, but I woke up and I did have the honor of going back out to Arrowhead, Kansas City Stadium yesterday for a Ronald McDonald House event, which was fantastic. But it was like, where am I supposed to be? Do I need my credential today? Oh, I don't need my credential.
Yeah.
Anymore. Yeah. That was heartbreaking. I told my husband, I'm like, somebody needs to tell me where I need to be, which hour, where am I going, where am I parking? Like, it was deflating yesterday to think, oh, that was it.
That's it.
Now, we've got a lot of work ahead of us, not only to recap everything about the World Cup and then look to the future of what we do with KC 2026 as an organization and an LOC and, you know, how do we wind it down and all that. Those discussions are all happening. But then now the door to the world has been open. I mean, my inbox is crazy on different people around the world. Hey, come to my country. Let me show you what we do. We're interested in Kansas City. It's almost overwhelming.
So I don't know if you had a chance to read the New York Times article. The headline reads, Kansas City, the smallest World Cup host, has the world at its feet. And there's this huge photo of all of the fans wearing orange that we hosted for the Dutch World Cup soccer team. The article is a love letter, Kathy, to Kansas City. It says, we are now in the same conversations as all of the other big cities when it comes to tourism and meetings and conventions. And you're quoted in the article. That doesn't mean you had time to read it. But they just gush about how this went for us.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. You know, these opportunities don't come along often. Obviously, World Cup's only every 4 years, and it'll be at least a decade before it even considers coming back to the United States. And even if we would be part of that or not, I would hope we would be if they do pick the U.S. again. But you have to jump on these opportunities when they're here. And our city did. Our city showed up. Our elected officials on both sides of the state line were fantastic to work with. And Kansas City poured its heart into this. And I think that's why we're all a little deflated today, is that what do we do now?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very different.
So when you say, what do we do now? Let's talk about the Women's World Cup and conversations ongoing about we can do this. Let's toast the women. Are those conversations starting?
Oh, they started years ago. So right now what's happening with Women's World Cup is they will start meetings once FIFA and everyone get back to Zurich and they get through the finals. They'll, you know, they won't catch their breath either. Like us, they're now working on the next World Cup for both men's and women's. And then what does 2031 look like? So they will meet, FIFA Congress will meet later this year, November, December. I think date is yet to be determined. And that's when they will vote on who to award the 2031 event to. If that is the United States, we have partnered with Mexico, Jamaica, and Costa Rica for our bid that's been submitted by U.S. Soccer. So we are hopeful that they select us, that four-country bid. So then what happens then is, just like it did for Men's World Cup, then we, all the cities that are interested, will then start to compete against each other. Right now we've all joined arms, clasped, all walking the same direction and getting this to be awarded to U.S. and Mexico. And after that, the gloves come off and we're like, okay, me against you now to get it to actually happen in our city.
And when is that decision made if we go forward and cross that first bar?
It will be probably mid to late next year.
Okay.
You know, it takes a while for cities to get ramped up because FIFA's got to figure out what they want from us. There will be things that our cities will want to do differently next time. We will look at this differently. The approach will feel and look different from a back of house operations perspective, from a contract perspective. I think both FIFA and host cities have learned so much. We will approach this differently, both good and bad. So that has yet to be worked out. And then from there, that's when we'll start to figure out who, you know, which city's hosting what, and all those things have yet to be determined.
Give us an example of the things that you would change moving forward. I know there was some like issues with transportation on the first day, and then you guys corrected those. What else is out there that if you could, you would do differently next time?
Oh, I think hotel contracts is a big piece of the puzzle for every city, whether they've been at one of the 11 host cities or not. All the hotels would approach contracting with FIFA differently.
Yeah.
We probably would continue to book normal business over those few weeks instead of just shutting everything out.
Yes.
I think we all learned that we could still host weddings and events, that traffic wasn't back to back. You could still come to work. Just those types of things that we can welcome the world into our city and still do business as is. Those are lessons that we've learned throughout these last couple months.
Hey, Kathy, this is Dan Weinbaum. You know, we've been focusing on international soccer, of course, the men's and possibly the women's. What about other events like the Men's Rugby World Cup?
So USA has been selected for that. We are a finalist host city. They have narrowed it down to 17 cities that would be hosts for the matches. We now, our final bid is due August 31st. So I laugh, Dana, when you're like, are you taking a month off? I'm like, no, we do not have time. We have a Rugby World Cup bid due the end of August, which is a pretty heavy lift. And working through, just like we did with FIFA World Cup, stadiums, airport, hotels, practice facilities, base camps, all the above, and working with the governing body of World Rugby to see if our city is a fit. Those awards, hopefully, they'll start to do site visits this fall, and then we'll know by beginning of next year if we're a finalist or if we have been awarded Rugby World Cup.
So does it look like to other people outside of the metro area that Kansas City is actually a legit place to hold these international events?
Yes, absolutely. We have the eye rolls, my favorite thing. I always joke about with my counterparts. I was like, oh, here we go, Kansas City again. I'm like, yeah, do you get why?
Yeah.
Do you see why?
I hate to say I told you so, but say it for you. You told everybody so. This worked. This worked even better than we thought it was going to work.
Yes, I told you. Yeah, that has been probably one of the most fun things about my job. I adore all of my counterparts in the other cities. We all enjoy each other's company, learn a lot from each other. But I also love when they're like, really, Kathy, really, again?
Yeah,
yeah. Again.
Denver is like super sad.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yes.
Kathy, last question, just from a skyline discussion. Where will that heart end up? I want it to stay right where it is. I don't know if that's... I love, like, during the Chiefs games and Monday Night Football, I want that heart illuminated as part of our, you know, Heart of America welcoming part. And I don't know if you're involved in those conversations. We want that heart here.
So that's complicated. The heart, as you know it, where it sits, will come down. That is a temporary structure, not meant to be permanent. And it will come down where it is currently located. And that structure could possibly be designed permanently to sit somewhere. A lot of discussion is happening about that, both with the mayor and then with our KC 2026 board of directors and executive board. I mean, it's more complicated than you think. So who builds it? I mean, Populous has the design.
Yeah.
Who pays to have it built? It's not cheap. It's extremely expensive to be built where it's permanent. Requires who's going to maintain it, who owns the grass that it sits on, how is it lit, how is it secured, making sure people don't climb on it. Like that, it sounds easy, like just build it, put it, you know, it's talked about at the airport, it's been talked about on the plaza, you know, out by the new baseball park. I mean, there's so many ideas that are all beautiful, great ideas, but the reality is when it comes to how do we keep this the right way, how do we do this the right way and keep it safe and secure is a whole nother conversation.
I didn't even think about people climbing on it. Of course you have to think about that.
Think about it. Yeah.
Maybe we electrify it. Do not touch the heart.
Do not touch it.
Anything else, Kathy, that we didn't ask that you want our listeners to know just after this historic run?
I think just today we all should be proud. We're all a little tired. We're very emotional that we're done. We still have our two teams to cheer on Wednesday, knowing that one of our Kansas City teams is going on to the final on Sunday. We should be extremely proud about all of that and our role in this, and cherish this moment. Keep this memory in your heart forever, wherever the heart structure lands permanently. But just know that we should be super proud of a city, of what we accomplished, and we welcomed the world here, and we had fun with them. We had fun with so many people, and it made the world a lot smaller. And it really showcased not only Kansas City, but the United States in a whole. And I truly think it healed us. It made us feel like, oh, I should visit Kansas City. I should visit the United States. So it's all a great day.
I love that you brought that up. I do think it was one of the most healing events. Sports has a way of doing that. And please thank your team on behalf of everyone here at KMBZ. And we cannot wait to hear about rugby, because we're happy to welcome them too.
I love that. I can't wait. Those are a lot of fun, too.
I know. Be well, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Kathy Nelson, the president and CEO of Visit KC and the Kansas City Sports Commission. We will be back with much more straight ahead on Dana and Parks. So even watching over the weekend, every time I watch a match, I have new questions. And one of the questions that we're going to pose to you this hour comes to us. Reuters has the story, but the findings in what we're going to talk about here were presented at some gigantic Alzheimer's convention full of very, very, very smart doctors and researchers and clinicians.
Okay.
And one of the questions I continually have when I watch these soccer matches is, why do they not wear head protection? And I've noticed this, Sam, when they do the header, and I know that they know how to do it, and there are ways to do it to minimize the, you know, you don't break your skull open, and I understand that.
They're professionals.
They are professionals. Most often, it appears to me that the injuries aren't because one single player strikes the ball with their head. The injuries come as when they are heading it, three or four guys are all going up to head the same ball.
They're going up competing for it, and lo and behold,
heads while they are heading.
Either somebody's forehead or the back of somebody's head goes straight into somebody's temple, and boom, you have a minor concussion.
I don't know that they could wear a helmet like an NFL helmet. Yeah. It wouldn't need to be anything like that. Why not wear something that could be protective in nature that isn't restrictive in the way a football helmet would be?
So you will see that on some players. So if there's a player who, they're known for their height, they're known for their jumping ability, every single corner they're going to be in the box trying to get that header into the goal, they will bang up their head pretty bad. And so you'll see, and you saw it on a couple of the players throughout the World Cup, one of them had like a jaw, almost like a chin strap.
Yeah,
there was
I saw
no
that.
Helmet. That is a piece of concussion protocol. They also will have like a super thin headband with a pad on one side of their head or a pad on the other side of their head. If they've taken a lot of blows to that same spot,
okay,
and they're getting repeated concussions, because if you take a blow there and then you take another and then another and then another, the concussions build, the damage builds.
But that seems like a Band-Aid to me, Sam, because you're still, your brain is still knocking around inside of your skull on the impact if there isn't a super hard surface the way there is a helmet. And even with a helmet, like a football helmet, there's still going to be some impact.
Well, and that still does happen with the football helmet, and that's part of the problem with football helmet technology, is they've perfected limiting the impact of the cranium itself.
Yeah.
They cannot seem to figure out how to limit the impact
of
the brain smacking against the inside of your skull.
So listen to what this study showed over the weekend. Former soccer players show brain changes, but no cognitive decline. Former soccer players show brain changes, but no cognitive decline. And before you think we're going to celebrate the findings here, that is a very rosy headline for what I'm about to tell you, okay? Retired British professional soccer players showed structural brain differences and high rates of anxiety and depression, three times the rate, by the way, of anxiety and depression, but did not show signs of cognitive decline in a study that looked to establish if repetitive impacts like heading the ball affect the risk of developing dementia. The study included 142 former players aged 30 to 60 and then compared them to a bunch of healthy people with no history of contact sports or military service or past concussions. So they just took a whole bunch of normal people that don't play football or soccer or anything like that, and they looked at that against these 152 former high-achieving soccer players, okay? Athletes reported much higher rates of mental health struggles, with 31% meeting the threshold for clinical depression compared to 9% of the control group, 42% reporting clinical anxiety compared to 25% in the other group. Researchers found that the brain scans of the former players showed that as a group, they had less brain tissue in areas controlling memory and emotion than the control group. But only 2% of the former athletes they looked at showed individual signs of severe brain shrinkage that would point to active progression and neurodegeneration. And that's important, you guys, because we're seeing the same thing in the NFL. There are some players that took a lot of hits who seem fine. Well, and then there are a handful of players, we know this, that end up with horrifying rage, dementia, all of the things that we've seen, the suicides, that maybe did not have the same number or frequency of the what we would consider a bad concussion or hit.
Frequency and severity are the two biggest factors here, because you can take a ton of small hits and still get similar damage to a few really, really big hits. The problem with the NFL and with the rules and the way it was taught for a very long time, because even I, when I was in grade school, was taught to lead with my head. I'm only 29 years old. And so we talk about the impact of football and the impact of soccer. Soccer is known as being far worse for the head injury,
yes,
because nobody really focuses on it, because we spend so much time focusing on the other sports because the impacts are so much more aggressive.
So let me ask you this. Why and when do those conversations start? And for any of you who have children who play high school soccer, certainly college soccer.
Well, if you're a soccer family, it is a conversation that you have. We talked about it growing up.
We talk about it all the time with football. Where is the conversation with respect to soccer? Even if you said to me, let's say your son is going to play college level, even D2 soccer. If you said to me that a whole bunch of these players in this test were 3 times more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety, and they did show differences in their brain scans, would that not start the conversation about headgear? Why not just have everybody wear headgear? That seems the simplest, straightest.
You assume the risk of the sport when you sign on to play it for the rest of your life, and you sign on at a very early age. It's what you love.
We used to say that about football before we had modern day helmets, and we have made technological strides. It's not perfect, but it's better than it was. Isn't
barely.
Something better than nothing?
You're not going to talk soccer players into wearing headgear.
913-586-7798, unless the league came out and said, look, there's enough evidence here. We've seen what happened in the NFL. We're going to do it. And why haven't they? We'll talk about that straight ahead on Dana and Parks. Ooh, a little bit of breaking news to pass along to you. The first in a string of cases have been filed after the downtown days in Lee's Summit. Part of this is good news, and part of this is going to annoy you. If you've forgotten, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens.
Hundreds.
Misbehaving children.
Waves. A stampede.
Literally shut down downtown days as we know it in Lee's Summit.
We saw a video of a number of people physically striking a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
Bear spray.
I have a question about that. From Fox 4. Police have taken their next step in their investigation into the disturbance that happened last month at the Lee's Summit Downtown Days Festival. The Lee's Summit Police Department announced today that detectives have submitted 7 cases to Jackson County after reviewing surveillance videos, witness statements, and other evidence gathered during the investigation.
Good.
That is the good news. Here's the bad news. There are only 7 cases. I would argue there should have been 30, if not more. And the cases that have been submitted to family court in the juvenile system.
So they're going to get a slap on the wrist. They might, get juvenile diversion or something.
Some
and then
of
off
those
their record by
teenagers,
the time they turn
18. Sam, were 16, 17, 18, dare yep. I say. We've seen the videos. Now, were there 12 and 13-year-olds running around acting a fool? Absolutely.
Which could make for the argument about why there's only 7 cases being pushed up for the potential of charges, because you could easily draw the conclusion that X number of those teens, whatever age they were just reacting to the crowd and weren't themselves trying to cause a problem.
Older teenagers should be charged as adults.
I agree.
Officers responded, I will remind you, to multiple fights, assaults, property damage, large groups of juveniles who then refused to disperse, weapons-related calls during the festival. They recovered a firearm, 3 cans of bear spray after multiple people were exposed to the bear spray. The court will now decide whether formal charges should be filed, and police say that is the standard process for all juvenile cases in Missouri. Department has thanked community members, witnesses who shared the videos, the information, and because the kids are juveniles, we're not going to learn any more about this. It just goes away.
Yep.
And so
They could get off scot-free and we wouldn't even know it.
That is correct.
Unless they get approved to be charged as an adult.
But I don't think that's going to happen. This has been submitted to the juvenile court system.
What about the young woman that was seen striking a police officer in the back?
The young woman who is on top of that police officer, and we don't know if she's one of the seven charges here or not, she looked plenty old enough to be part of the adult system.
I bet you that these kids walk. I'm just being honest.
I hope you're wrong.
Just being honest.
And then this story that for all 30 years of my career has puzzled me with respect to how it is legal to do what we do. And I'm not saying I disagree with it. I'm just saying I don't understand how it's legal.
Okay.
On the Missouri side, the Attorney General today has moved to permanently commit a repeat sex offender who was one day from release. And we do this all the time, by the way. Missouri Attorney General Catherine Hanaway filed today to civilly commit a repeat sex offender who was one day from release. 42-year-old Benjamin Waltz was scheduled for release this week. He will now remain in custody while the proceedings against him to commit him civilly move forward, okay? The AG notes that the Johnson County Sheriff's Office referred Waltz to her office for review after his probation was revoked following a recent arrest. And here we go. He, despite a long criminal history of sex offenses, failed to register as a sex offender, number one, was found loitering near a school in the Warrensburg area, number two. Oh, wait for it, allegedly sexually assaulted a woman in the Warrensburg area. Court records show that Sheriff's Office formally notified the AG on April 15th that Waltz had a prior conviction for a sexually violent offense and had committed recent overt acts on top of his original conviction. Under Missouri law, as any act that creates a reasonable apprehension of harm of a sexually violent nature, you are able to commit these men and women, although I think it's predominantly men. In 2002, he was convicted of sexual battery in Florida. In 2011, convicted of felonious kidnapping. 2020, convicted of second-degree sexual abuse. And 2024, violated numerous sex offender registration requirements.
Because they're proving to be an ongoing threat. That's
absolutely.
Obviously not going to get the picture absolutely. Of, hey, you can't be doing this, you weirdo.
In addition to his convictions, the AG office says Walt has multiple arrests for incidents of a sexual nature that either didn't result in charges or for whatever reason, charges were later dismissed. And we all know that doesn't mean he didn't do it. It just means procedurally, there are a slew of other cases that did not see their way all the way through court. Okay.
Right.
So what happens now? They do this mental health evaluation. Under our laws, and I think it's in Kansas and Missouri, don't they go to Larned? I'd have to look this up.
I do believe so,
You
yeah.
can continue to keep someone that we believe is an ongoing threat only in these sexually violent cases.
Good.
And I'm not saying I don't want these people locked up. In a million years, you would not want this guy living next to you or your daughter or your granddaughter. He is a repeat sexual deviant offender. I've never understood how this got through the court system, though, that once you have served your sentence, a state can then say, we're going to move you from padded cell A to a mental place B.
Because obviously—
So that you can no longer offend. Because, Sam, people reoffend all the time for a million different crimes.
Well— I mean, does that not deserve some of the same conversation? We talk about the guy along Indian Creek who is accused of killing seven people and
it.
Has been in and out of the competency investigation for the last, almost 10 years now?
In a perfect world to me, you put these offenders away the first time. God knows the second time. I mean, he had four that I just repeated between 2002 and 2024.
And those were cases that stuck.
You put them away and you throw away the key.
Yeah.
I've never understood how it's legal under our Constitution that once they serve their sentence, as short as that may be, we can then recommit them somewhere else. And again, I am not here to advocate for the release of these nuts. You would not want to be anywhere near one of these men.
Well, in 30, 40 years ago, that wouldn't even have been a thought that you had, because that was the common practice. So does the Constitution have anything to do about it? Did it go to a constitutional court back then?
I think it's been through the court, Sam. And for whatever reason, when it comes to a violent sexual predator who cannot seem to stay out of trouble, it is legal to put them away. And again, I am thrilled they are putting him away. I just don't understand under our system of laws how we can do it. Or we should be able to put everyone away that can't. You know what I mean? Like, you can't stop stealing.
I mean, we did that for a while.
He will undergo a full evaluation by the Department of Mental Health, and then a judge will determine whether he should be civilly committed as a sexually violent predator.
I want to key on that one for a second. Why do we need to give him a mental health evaluation? We can look at his actions and pretty well figure out how he's doing upstairs.
Because if you're going to take someone's freedom away after they've served their sentence, I think you have to go through that process.
But the mental health evaluation would be whether or not
he's nuts.
Competent.
He's a sexually deviant.
We know he's not competent.
Well, I don't know if it's competency. It's, is he sexually deviant? And the answer is yes.
Got it.
The answer is most certainly yes. 913-586-7798. We'll wrap up the hour straight ahead. I looked this up during a break because I'd forgotten about this particular case, and it's Kansas. The United States Supreme Court set the precedent that we can take sexually violent predators after they have served their sentences, and we can move them over here because they're a danger to society. Precedent was set in 1997, and the case was Kansas versus Hendricks. The ruling established that these commitments, these civil commitments, do not violate double jeopardy because they are civil and not criminal.
Oh,
and the government has to, there's a bar that you have to reach to keep an offender in custody through court. It's like prior convictions, mental abnormality is one of them. The future danger quotient, like how dangerous is this person if they get out?
Right.
And for indefinite confinement, the individual's then transferred to a secure state psychiatric facility for, quote, treatment. Now, I would argue with the violent sex offender, there's no coming back from that. If you have that thing, that is your thing, I do not think you can be rehabilitated. I truly don't. But I mean, there are people that would say that about all kinds of crimes.
I don't believe that you can be rehabbed from finding children attractive or finding abusing
violence?
Someone in a sexual way
I don't
attractive.
Either. I absolutely don't either. But look it up. Kansas versus Hendricks, and the court ruled in favor of Kansas. There's a list out today of America's 10 worst states to live in for 2026.
Ooh, how'd we do?
Not good, Sam. The top 10 is as follows. I'm going to give you a handful, and then I'm going to wait for number one. And number one is the worst, by the way. You don't want to be number one.
We're not number one, right?
Coming in at number 10, Arkansas. It's the most improved state overall this year on the list, but is still the 10th worst when you look at quality of life,
okay,
crime rates, air quality, healthcare, inclusiveness of state laws, and reproductive rights. That's what they looked at. But crime was a big one. Arkansas comes in as 10th worst, followed by Oklahoma, Alabama, which ranks dead last for mental health providers per capita, even though nearly a quarter of residents in Alabama have been told by a health professional that they have a depressive disorder. They rank at the bottom for worker protections and some other things. So Alabama is bad, coming in at number 7. 6th worst, Missouri.
Hey, go Missouri!
462 violent offenses per 100,000 residents in 2024, according to the FBI. Missouri is among America's most violent states. We also ranked Missouri in the top 10 for firearm deaths last year. Quality of life score was low, D minus.
What? According to who?
We did get a bump in our score, meaning we would have been worse because our air quality is decent and our worker protections are decent. Rounding out the top five, Utah, Georgia, Louisiana, with the nation's fifth highest violent crime rate, Indiana, Texas, and America's worst place to live in 2026, Tennessee.
Okay. Tennessee. Feel really biased.
Crime, worker protections, well, quality of life score. Tennessee came in at 64 out of 290 points. Sorry, Tennessee. But let's not be celebrating. Missouri is in the top 10.
Tennessee's a fine state. Yeah, whatever.
913-586-7798. We're going to break for the news with Dan Weinbaum quick and back with much more on Dana and Parks straight ahead.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.